subject today is conservative Judaism for the next 20 years. And in thinking about this, the way we're going to have the format will be I'm going to ask a number of questions and then we'll have a chance to deal with a number of different issues. But in reflecting upon it, one of the things that I was thinking about was how difficult it is to imagine what the world will be like 20 years from now. In the spirit of where we are here in Las Vegas, what we're going to do is at the end of the conference, at the end of the session, you're going to be able to place your bets and see which one of the three of these panelists comes closest to being correct. But we look at what the world was like 20 years ago. In 1991 was the disintegration of the Soviet Union. Here we are, we're witnessing now the disintegration, in many respects, of Arab regimes that have been there for 40 and 60 years. As the famous saying goes, it's so difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. But I want you to know, I have written a piece of paper here 20 years ago, 1991, and predicting what would happen in the year 2011. I want to open it up for you. It says, to be read at an RA convention 20 years from now at the Concord. See, I predicted, just out of the blue, I said, we will communicate with handheld phones, and our kids, instead of speaking, will actually prefer to type. Number two, I said, we will elect a black president. I predicted that. And number three, that the Red Sox will win a World Series, but not the Cubs. Anyway, obviously, it's none of us could predict any of these things, but as we are rabbis engaged in the American Jewish community and beyond, whether it's in Israel or in South America, in the Jewish community, it's so important to anticipate in order to be able to plan, and we're especially fortunate to have three very gifted and talented rabbis with us today. The last thing that I want to say by way of introduction is in the spirit of looking to the future, I came across a quote the other day by Wayne Gretzky, which was fascinating. And Wayne Gretzky, the great one, said, I don't skate to the puck, I skate to where it will be. And that's very appropriate in terms of introducing our discussion today. We have with us Rabbi David Wolpe, who is no stranger to us, the rabbi of Temple Sinai in Sinai Temple in Los Angeles, where he's taught at the Jewish Theological Seminary, as well as the American Jewish University at UCLA. He's the author of a number of books, as well as articles that are published widely, whether it's in the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, and elsewhere. One of his best-selling books is called Making Loss Matter, Creating Meaning in Difficult Times. And his most recent one is entitled Why Faith Matters. Next, we have Jeremy Kalmowski, who served as rabbi of the congregation Anshei Chesed in Manhattan, where he has helped to develop a very vibrant community, ordained at JTS in 1997. He's been there since 2001 for the past 10 years and serves on the editorial board of Conservative Judaism. And then finally, we have with us Rabbi Ed Feinstein. Ed is senior rabbi of Valley Beth Shalom in Encino, California, where he teaches at the Ziegler Rabbinical School and the Wexner Heritage Foundation. Some of Ed's books include Tough Questions Jews Ask, A Young Adult's Guide to Building a Jewish Life, and Jews and Judaism in the 21st Century, both of which were National Jewish Book Award finalists. And so we have three very talented pulpit rabbis who are with us. Naomi Levy was scheduled to be here. Unfortunately, her mother is ill, and therefore Naomi is not with us this morning. So let me begin by asking the first question, and that is, if we're going to look 20 years into the future, let's first start by looking 20 years ago. And that is, if you could share with us, we'll just go around, and that is, what did the American Jewish community look like 20 years ago? What did your rabbinate look like 20 years ago? What were some of your thoughts? And if you were asked in 1991, where are we going, what trends might you have anticipated? David?
I think that the trend that none of us would have anticipated, which is the most significant, one of the most significant at the moment, is social media. Which we're now in the midst of this whirlpool, and I don't think any of us know exactly where it's going, but we know that it's incredibly significant, and we're trying to create virtual communities, all of us. Part of me thinks that the reason they're called virtual is because they're not real, and that we will lose an immeasurable amount, but I'm not sure that we have any choice in the matter. On the other hand, you know, you discover, I mean, I set up a Facebook page about a year ago, and it has thousands and thousands of people on it, and a lot of them are Jews and a lot of them are Christians, and part of our task now is to reach beyond the Jewish community, I think, in a way that we didn't as much previously. So that's one trend, is the social media and the reaching beyond the boundaries of the Jewish community. And then, this is a much longer conversation, but if I'm going to be a provocateur, I would say the other trend, specifically in conservative Judaism, is what will replace our assertion that we're a halachic movement. What are we going to put in its place that will still be compelling as a rationale, as an ideologically coherent rationale for a conservative Judaism? The truth is, I could have told you that 20 years ago. I just don't think we've made much progress on it. And the day is late, and the hour is short, and we need an answer.
Thank you. Jeremy, looking back 20 years ago.
Well, I can't tell you what my rabbi was like 20 years ago because I had not yet begun JTS. But if I look back a little bit more than 20 years, a little bit more, closer to 25 years, I thought about it and made the observation, similar to what David said, that 25 years ago you had neither heard the word internet nor intifada. And that would, I think, sum up much of the transformations that have gone on in American Jewish life, and world Jewish life certainly, social media in ways that David said, and our attachment and the meaning of the Jewish people's investment in Medinat Yisrael, which we are obviously still working on in no obvious way, no obvious clear answers to those persistent questions. I'm sure everybody read. I just got louder, didn't I? You just turned that up. I'm sure everybody read Peter Beinart's article from a year or so ago in the New York Review of Books about this topic, and there was much in it that was correct. But if I can extrapolate a little bit out of American Jewish life more broadly, Peter Beinart identified that American Jewish attachment to Israel was problematized principally because of the putative illiberalism of Israeli policies. I think that there is certainly something to this. But the other thing is that we are living in a post-ethnic America, and I don't think 20 years ago or 25 years ago, America was nearly as post-ethnic, and that is, I think, one of the major, major transformative features of American Jewish life. So I'm sure we'll have more opportunity to develop this. I wouldn't say the same thing that David said about what needs to replace halakha, but I would say that the ascendance of orthodoxy as a system of meaning presents a different challenge to us. That I think that we have failed to answer that challenge at least as deeply as failed to answer the challenge of the depth of normative Judaism as we have a need to answer a post-normative Judaism.
And Ed, your thoughts, please.
I want to go back 40 years ago. I want a microphone that works. I want my voice to be heard in the conservative movement. I want someone to listen to me. Except my wife.
All you have to do is turn it on.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's it, David. You don't need a halacha. Just turn it on. 40 years ago, our teacher, Abraham Joshua Heschel, came to this conference at the Concord, and he said to the conservative rabbinate, "The American synagogue has caught a cold. It is empty and hollow of spiritual life. God has deserted this movement. Prayer is perfunctory and boring." He said to the General Assembly of the Jewish Federations that he wanted to banish two words from the Jewish vocabulary, surveys and survival. He said, "We have enough statistics, we don't need any more. What we need is depth. And to make survival the purpose of Jewish life is a hollow and empty goal. Only an animal survives for its own sake. We have to survive for purpose." But 40 years ago, nobody heard Heschel's voice because we were still numb from the Holocaust. And so we put our heads down and decided that we would build and build and build and build, and that would be our response to the destruction that we had witnessed. 20 years ago, we began to hear Heschel. 20 years ago, young people presented themselves to us and said, "Why be Jewish? Being Jewish is no longer a reflex. Joining a synagogue is no longer a reflex. And responsive readings is not a way to pray to God. We want something more. 20 years ago, the Jewish community awoke to the need, to the needs that Heschel had articulated. And that's what we've been struggling with for the last 20 years.
So let's talk and let's start to get into some of the specific issues now as we look 20 years into the future. The first question I want to propose is, so what and how will we turn people on to being Jewish? What will excite them? What excites us? And what? How and what will turn people on?
Start there this time.
Ed.
No, David, you said.
No. You said, no. I think deference will turn them on. Please, Ed.
Look, I came today to answer a different question, so I'm going to apologize to you and say what I wanted to say.
I do.
Because I haven't been to one of these conferences in a long time, and when I'm finished with what I'm about to say, I may not ever get invited again.
As long as you pay your dues, you get invited.
That's the truth. We are in deep trouble. There isn't one demographic that is encouraging for the survival of the conservative movement. Not one. Conservative Judaism as an idea has triumphed. It's so triumphed that the Reform movement and the left part of the Orthodox community have now joined us in being conservative Jews. The Reform movement has now decided that they need a normative structure, because absent a normative structure, religion just becomes narcissistic. It becomes an impulse of the sovereign self. And the left wing of the Orthodox, the part that lives in the world that we live in, has decided that they have to be responsive to modernity. As an idea, conservative Judaism has won. But as a movement, we are dying. Read Stephen Cohen's reports. They're depressing. They'll keep you up, but they're dying. Now the question is why? It's not because we don't have big ideas. We have the most remarkably big ideas. And in politics, any politician will tell you that you tried to capture the ideological middle, and we have done that. And it's not because we don't have big people. This is the great mystery to me. How can a movement populated by these people, led by a man as brilliant and sensitive as Arne Eisen, and David Wolpe, and Jeremy Kamenevsky, and Stu Weinblatt, and Brad Artson, and Danny Nevins, and Neil Gilman, and the list goes on. How can a community led by these people be failing? It's remarkable. So I want to offer a third alternative. If it's not big ideas and it's not big people, the third option is that we are a dysfunctional organization. So this year, Michael Siegel, whom I love, I used to, drafted me to be part of this reorganization of United Synagogue. It's my first foray into national Jewish politics. Very interesting experience. At first, I look at this, and I look at the United Synagogue and the Rabbinical Assembly and the seminary and all the institutions, the conservative movement, and I said to myself, this is mighty dysfunctional. And then I had an insight. It's not dysfunctional. It was designed this way. Solomon Schechter was our architect. He loved American democracy. So he built the conservative movement on the model of American democracy, with checks and balances. A rabbinical assembly, a seminary, a United Synagogue, a women's league, and all the other institutions, and they check each other so that we have leaders, but no leadership. So that we have conferences, but no directions. So that we have worries, but no solutions. We have a camping movement and a youth movement that don't talk to each other. And together, they don't talk to the people who run day schools, who in turn don't talk to the people who run congregations. We have schools of education preparing educators, but they have nothing to do with the consultants who go into the communities to support the educators. We have nobody who deals with early childhood education. We have two of the most brilliant scholars of 21st century synagogues, Jack Wertheimer and Ron Wolfson, both of whom tried to create institutes of synagogue leadership within the conservative movement and were turned back. So they went outside the conservative movement and created Synagogue 2000 and created the Avichai Studies. We have leaders but no leadership. And unless we get our act together, Stephen Cohn, the demographer, gives us 7 years. The demography of the conservative movement is going to take its toll in 7 years, and we will crumble from the inside out if we don't get our act together, if we don't integrate these institutions, if we don't get them working together and speaking together and give us a voice in the community. There is nobody in this movement who goes to every Ramah camp every summer, gathers the staff together, and inspires them to become leaders of conservative Judaism tomorrow. There needs to be. And asks them to become rabbis and cantors and educators and executives. There's nobody who goes to Solomon Schechter day schools and recruits the next generation of lay leaders and professional leaders. There needs to be. There's no one who speaks for all of us together, and there needs to be. We have great leaders. Julie is a remarkable executive at this organization, and we're proud to have him as our leader. Steve Wernick has done heroic work in keeping United Synagogue alive. Remarkable work. And Arnie Eisen is a gift from God. It is an indication that God hasn't given up on the conservative movement, that he's our chancellor. But if we don't get this together, we are going to die. If we don't integrate, we're going to disintegrate. That's what we need to do. Now I'm going to go home to LA and finish my career.
I'm especially concerned when you say the conservative movement only has 7 more years. I just signed an 8-year contract, so I'm going to... But gentlemen, do either of you have a...
We have room for another assistant in my place. If you don't mind doing bar mitzvahs on Shabbos afternoon.
Yeah. Jeremy, Dave, do you want to respond to Ed's points before we get some other issues here? Yeah.
You know, I think that the deep problems that we face... Well, I don't disagree with anything that you said.
Thank you.
I'm sure you're glad to hear that. I don't disagree with anything that you said, but I also don't think that the real problem is that our organizations just don't run smoothly enough, that we're not a more unified machine. And let's also note that a lot of the thriving that is going on in the American Jewish community is very decentralized and very grassroots, so it is not clear to me that if we were just more centralized, this machine would be moving a lot faster. I would say that you underestimated the strength of your first point, which is that we have the right answer about a great many of the spiritual problems that face American Jewish life. I think that it is profound that we occupy a center that both to our left and to our right, people are adopting some of our rhetoric. I feel very, very confident, very, very confident that in 20 years there will be a thriving, serious, learned, heterodox, halachic Judaism. I don't know that our institutions will be the ones that will nurture it. I think in 20 years you will see a split in American Jewish life between those people who practice Judaism and those who are of Jewish ancestry. And the question is whether or not we are in our institutions, in our synagogues, and in our schools, and in our professional associations, on the side of those who are practicing Judaism. I think that a lot of the thriving that we did in this movement over the last 50 and 100 years can be seen in our successes in a couple of different ways. This movement was built to help Jews Americanize. It was built to help immigrant Jews fit in this new society. We know that's why the seminary was founded, because the already Americanized German Jews wanted to help the Easterners fit in better. Our institutions thrive when we help people suburbanize. Post-World War II, we built some impressive institutions as people moved out of cities. But those transformations that conservative Judaism helped people along were fundamentally about helping people belong in a bigger society. It was about helping people belong in a society that was changing. It mediated their contact with the non-Jewish world. And let me remind you folks, when we talk about changes and transformation, we're not talking about the policies of one relatively small religious organization. We're talking about societal transformations that are much bigger. We can't control them. We can't control the economy. You know, people talk about the decision of the conservative movement 50 or 60 years ago to endorse driving on Shabbat to shul. People say, oh, that was a mistake, or it was a mistake. I have to say that I think, I don't agree with the decision, but I think that as an impactful thing, it was almost totally irrelevant. Interstates created the phenomenon of driving to shul on Shabbat. Suburban communities created that phenomenon, not a halachic ruling. We helped people experience and mediated for them huge social transformations in immigration, in suburbanization, in becoming part of a very thriving American middle class. I want to think of another transformation, though, about the egalitarianization of Judaism that was not about... It abutted the transformations that were going on in society, but it was a different sort of transformation. It was a transformation of moral purpose. Right? We said, as a movement, that we had a religious vision to articulate, and that we were going to remain halachic. We were going to remain a kind of heterodox halachic, both faithful and critical. We were going to be serious. But that there was a compelling moral purpose that was going to alter our relationship to tradition. It would seem to me that what is before us, if we are to thrive, is not only a matter of better coordination between the Ramah movements and United Synagogue youth, which would be wonderful, but if we are going to survive, it's not only because people need community. They do need community, but they need a particular kind of community, and that is the kind of community that lives spiritual and moral purpose. I think that for us to adapt to America in the coming... I know not everybody here is a North American. I would expect that the things that I say are true of Israel as well. I know nothing about Latin America, so forgive me. But if we're going to really thrive, we're going to have to be a religion. We're going to have to be a religion. A religion that helps people have moral and spiritual purpose, that builds communities of moral and spiritual purpose. Trying to help people belong, I think, is much more dubious in the coming century. People don't belong in the same ways that they used to. They're much more eclectic. They're much more voluntaristic. They cross all kinds of boundaries. If we are going to succeed, it's not because people have Jewish ancestry, but because we help them find drachim for moral and spiritual purpose.
So we've heard two different perspectives here. Ed pointing to some of the bleakness in our movement. Jeremy, a much more hopeful response. David, where do
you want me to take the middle road?
Yeah.
So the first thing I want to say is, if the continued discussion blunts, obscures, makes us forget what Eddie said earlier, that would be a tragedy. Because what he said was enormously important. And I remember 7 or 8 years ago, on a suggestion actually originally from Bob Wexler from the AJU, I said at an RA convention, look, Jerry Epstein, Joel Myers, Ismar Shorsch, they're all on the verge of retiring. If the three of them would get together and pick someone and say, you will be the titular head of the conservative movement, so that someone doesn't have to fulfill all these different functions and compete for head, wouldn't that be a wonderful... And I spoke to all three of them individually. Nobody went for the idea. The fact that we are discoordinated is not a trivial thing. It's a central thing. And anybody who, I mean, all you have to do is study companies that succeed and companies that fail. So it really does matter. And I hope that that won't be ignored, because I'm about to talk about other things. Because it's not just that I agree with what Eddie said. I think it's incredibly important. I've talked about this before, and I'm not going to go through the whole spiel, and I talked about it last year at the RA. We don't have a coherent and cohering ideology. We just don't. And that matters. We can't get our ideology out even if we have one, because our movement doesn't talk to itself, right? It's as if you had a body that has no centralizing brain. But it's not only that. The reason that you know where you can see that we don't have a cohering ideology? All these institutions that are full of spiritual vitality and interest that spring up, they're all run by conservative rabbis, and none of them call themselves conservative. Nashuva and Ikar and Hadar, they're all conservative, but none of them will call themselves conservative, because if they do, they won't have the constituency they have. Because everybody knows that what conservative is not. And what it is not is young and dynamic and spiritually enlivening and all those things that we think conservative Judaism is and can be. So unless we have, and I mean, look, I'm not going to go through the whole covenantal thing. That was my proposal. But I'm less wedded to the proposal than to the idea that we have a coherent ideology of the movement, so that when someone says to you, I said this last year. When the chancellor visited my synagogue, and I said to him, okay, we need a bumper sticker. We need to be able to say, when someone says, what is conservative Judaism, we need to be able to say, this is what it is. And you can't say tradition and change. That's a paradox. That's not a marching banner, right? Tradition and change. You can say Torah, true Judaism, if you're Orthodox. You can say social justice, if you're Reform. What do you say if you're conservative? Well, we're not this, and we're not that. Or you can say positive historical Judaism, which will get you very far with most Jews. So I said to him, give me your bumper sticker. And I have to tell you, some wealthy congregants, and some of them drive very large SUVs. But the largest SUV in the parking lot of Sinai Temple could not accommodate the bumper sticker that the chancellor enunciated. Right? It was full of nuance. It was full of thoughtfulness. It was an absolute failure when someone says, what do you believe? Right? What's on your bracelet instead of what would Jesus do? Right? What is it you believe? So I said the Judaism of relationship, right? That was my, I still think that that's what we are and that's what we should talk about. But until you have that, it doesn't matter. Except maybe on the Upper West Side of New York, it doesn't matter that you have a spiritual community. You need a marching order for people who don't live near you, who have to go to you, who don't observe Shabbos, who don't observe Kashrut, who had a rudimentary religious school education, and they want to know, what do you have to say to me that will compel me? My kids don't go to Ramah. And that's most conservative Jews, right? Most of them. So you need to be able to say something, and if you can't say something, then we don't have a movement.
Jeremy, please.
You know, I'm glad to sit next to you so I can disagree.
Okay. You can actually disagree from a distance, too, if you want at some future point.
And yet, this is a much better place. Mm. The reason I disagree is that it's not a bumper sticker, okay? This is... That's it?
Which of the people work for you?
I do live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and the institutions that you approvingly cited are in West LA and the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
Right.
And those are places that are thriving because it's not a bumper sticker. I'm not selling shoes. I'm selling a spiritual path. And I think that it is short-sighted to say, in an overly pragmatic way, what we need is a unifying ideology. I think that, in fact, in 20 years, we may well be a lot smaller. And I think that, by the way, everybody should, here on 2011, keep this in mind and plan for it. We are almost certain, as an American Jewish community, to be less affluent, right? long as I've been a Jewish professional, there has been money for every good idea. There's been money for every venture, and there will not be any more. We will need to plan for straightened circumstances. But as best as we can under those conditions, we need to seed and nurture and water and harvest opportunities for people to find depth. I think that one of the things that you see in a diverse world is that profusion of difference is actually a better thing than unified direction. It may be true that certain kinds of companies go good to great when they focus more and eliminate some of the extraneous motion. But I do not think that the conservative movement will win back the adherence of the people, the graduates of the seminary, the alumni of Ramah camps, who say, I'm not conservative, which I think is fatuous and self-congratulatory and ultimately just insufferable. I don't think that we're going to win that back by making sure that everybody sticks to their talking points. In fact, we're going to win that back by aligning ourselves with people who are trying to find religious depth and meaning. If I was going to put a bumper sticker, I'd go to the final page of Tractate Makot, okay, and I would go to that sugya where there's 613 commandments, and then David made them 15, and then Yeshaya made them 11 or so, and we'd boil them all down to Dirshuni v'chayu, seek me and live. I would make, what's the Gemara says in Tractate Brachot, B'chol derachecha ta'ehu. Our religious paths have to be nurturing the search for religious meaning through discipline, through observance, and that, folks, is not a bumper sticker. Now, you,
okay,
of course...
No, wait, no, that, because you're exactly wrong. Exactly wrong. I'll tell you why. When you say, listen to what a bumper says, when you say liberté, égalité, fraternité, that started the French Revolution. It wasn't simple-minded. When you say government of the people, by the people, for the people, to say that you can put it in a phrase doesn't make you simple-minded. It lets me know what you believe. When I ask you, what do you believe? And you say, I believe in a complex of tradition and spirit in which you go in depth and so on, I'm saying, okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I want to know it. And if you can't put it in a sentence, if you can't put it in a short sentence, then I know you don't know. That doesn't mean there is an infinite complexity behind what you say. Of course there is. B'chol drachecha da'ehu, there's infinite complexity behind that. But you gotta know what it is that you say when you say, what does a conservative Jew believe? And it cannot be the sacred cluster, because that's not what people want to hear. They want to know, tell me in a sentence, what do you believe? I can say that about my family. I can say that about my country. Why can't I say that about my religious path? And the idea that it makes it too simplistic is what I said in the last, as you could say, I feel very deeply about this. It's what I said in the last class. The Jewish Theological Seminary is the head of the movement in every sense of the word. Intellectual complexity is not how you bring people to a spiritual movement. It isn't. The way you bring them to a spiritual movement is you tell them what you stand for. And you don't stand for a path. Right? You stand for a principle that may launch you on the path, that may be the end of the path, but you don't stand for a path, right? You don't stand for a process. You stand for an idea, some idea that coheres an ideology. And if you don't have that, you can have a billion talking points. You can talk about nuance and complexity until you're blue in the face. But E.M. Chorin, the Romanian philosopher, said you don't beseech a nuance. Right? That's not what you got to pray to, something substantial and expressible and bumper stickerable.
So now we've got Jeremy and David's positions. I'm going to turn to Ed and tell me where you fall on the bumper sticker question.
I don't think they're that far apart. I think Jeremy is asking for a deep sophistication, and I think David recognizes that. And I think David is asking for a coherence of message, and I think Jeremy asks for that as well. And I think that they're not that far apart. I'm asking for something different. Once you figure out what your message is, I'd like there to be a messenger.
So you mentioned the first. You mentioned the first.
I'm a simple-minded guy. I could sit here and talk philosophy all night long.
Ed mentioned the first page. Well, you mentioned it as a Heschel's talk, but it's of course also the first page of God in Search of Man, in which Heschel says, religion didn't become insipid because its answers ceased to be good, but because it failed to nurture questions. I think that our communities will thrive. I'm not against eloquence. I'm not against being able to inspire people with message. I'm not against some vision in that way, but I don't think that controlling the answers, and I think that if there is a reason why our younger generation views us as monumentally uncool, okay? Why will Hadar and Ikar not identify with us? It is because we are monumentally uncool. And we are not going to be cool because we control the answers better, but because we are perceived, and genuinely are, stimulative of questions.
What does control mean? Nobody wants to control answers. To have a message is not to control an answer. It's a sort of pejorative way of saying it. If I tell you, for example, Torah true Judaism, is that controlling an answer? No, it's giving you a message. Look, 1,000 people come to Friday Night Live. Why do they come? It's not because it stimulates questions. That's not why. They come because the music is good, because the message is brief, because they can meet each other, because they can have community. Ikar's message is very simple, right? It is a social justice community. They don't say come to Ikar so that you can explore questions. They say come to Ikar because we believe Judaism is about social justice and we're going to give you a passionate and powerful message about it. And they do. And people come. Don't be against it. Look, here's what I think I want to say. In a movement that from the very beginning has been drowning in intellectualism, the answer is not more intellectualism. The answer is, we have professors, we have the seminary, we have the AJU, and I don't want to give up on that. I love intellectualism. I taught at all those places. But that's not what the person who walks into the congregation is looking for. They're not looking for JEP&D. They want to know, what do you believe?
Okay, I object to the suggestion that what I have proposed is sterile intellectualism, because every human being bestowed of a neshama goes on spiritual searches. I am not proposing that when people come seeking religious meaning, seeking an encounter with God, it is true, one does not, well, I don't know that one does not beseech a nuance. One certainly beseeches with nuance, but when people come seeking an experience with transcendent meaning, which is what religion must provide, they do so coming with all of the infinite depths of their neshama, and they go on a journey whether they know about biblical criticism or not. This, I think, is very important. I want to tell you one little Ikar anecdote, which I think proves you wrong. Again, this is a West LA organization, and I'm an Upper West Side rabbi, but I know that when Ikar had the first bar mitzvah in that institution, Sharon Brass was thinking about what gift to give the kid. Tzedakah box, sidur, chumash. And she gave the kid an empty box. An empty box. And she said, this was the most Ikar kind of gift I could give. And said, now fill it up. This is the kind of nurturing of religious growth and depth and journey that I think that our society and our communities ought to do to help give people a sense that by being Jewish, they are... I love the Am. I understand that the Am is a primary value in Judaism. But I do not think that in the next 20 years, we are mostly going to succeed because we help people feel, I am a part of the Am of my ancestors. I think we are mostly going to succeed because we help people find the surpassing meaning that is Torah. Torah is a 3,000-year-old conversation with between the Jewish people and the Ribono Shel Olam, what it means to live in a sacred way.
So before we get into some of those specifics, let me just cite this, and lest we think we're alone. A report about a national movement said the following, that we have not responded to the dramatic changes in the wider landscape of Jewish life. It went on to say that Jews today feel less of a sense of kinship with each other, denominational loyalty is less relevant, synagogues have become pass-through of communions for life cycle celebration. Intermarriage has made its mark, and now you realize what I'm referring to in just a moment, and almost half of the children being educated in our Reform synagogues are growing up in a family in which one parent was not born Jewish. Younger Jews are not joiners and see denominations as divisive or irrelevant. That's from this recent report that came out called Urgent Change, Lasting Transformation. I guess it would be the Reform equivalent of Hayom. So in certain respects, the issues we struggle with are not just ours. I imagine, I don't know if there's an Orthodox response to that as well. I want to get back to then the question in terms of what do we see as how to reach this generation of people who young people, I mean, we've touched upon it, we've danced around it, but I want to take it more specifically. Sociologist Bill McKinney said, we've become a society of believers, not belongers. Is that true or not, and how does that impact us? What do we see in terms of, within the context of our synagogue lives? We've spoken broadly. Let's deal with some of these issues as well.
I just watch you guys fight this out.
No, it comes back to the exact... I think it comes back to exactly what I was saying. Look, first of all, I'm not sure that anecdote from Yikar even comes close to proving me wrong, much less contradicting what I said. But even if it does, the issue is, has conservative Judaism promoted this idea in the past? And as far as I understand, it has. I've heard spiritual journey, Heschel, for a long time as our numbers ebb away. It's not as though we haven't said this. I ask each new rabbinical student, what do you think conservative Jews are failing, and if so, why? And they'll always say it's because we haven't gotten our message out. Right? But the answer is we have gotten our message out. We have taught spiritual language for a long time. We have spoken about spiritual community. It's not that we haven't done that. What we have not done, though, if you ask everybody in this room, okay, what does conservative Judaism stand for? My guess is you get 100 different answers. That if there are 200 people in the room, you get 100 different answers. Not 200, but 100 different answers, okay? Now, what that may be religiously a beautiful thing, but if you want a movement, that's not actually such a hot result. And if you say our message is Torah, well, that doesn't do it either, because there are lots of different ways of looking at Torah. An Orthodox rabbi also says our message is Torah. A Reform rabbi might also say our message is Torah, but what's your take on Torah? And so when you say to me, we become believers and not belongers, I'm saying that's exactly right. But if you have a community of believers, they want to know not what they have to believe. It's not an issue of control, but they want to know what you believe. And if we can't say that we believe something that they can understand, that we can put in a message, then why should I walk into that synagogue or that shul? Listen, we're all religious professionals. Most people are not. They don't walk into a synagogue saying, okay, I'm ready to devote a couple of years to study and path. Right? They say, I'm shopping for a synagogue. What do you guys think? And that's the reality of life out there in the world, in which I get on an average Shabbos morning, 96 to 97% of my congregants drive to shul. Most of them go out afterwards and play golf or go shopping. Some of them keep kosher at home. A lot of them don't. Maybe most of them don't. If you ask them, why are you part of this shul? They want to be able to articulate something that the shul believes, not just because their friends are there. I think this to me, I suppose that this is some kind of, I don't know, cognitive defect. It's so pshita that we have to be able to say, this is what we believe, that I find the objection to it unnerving, actually.
Are we talking even for 20-somethings and 30-somethings?
So what is the way in which you convey to those, 96 or 97% of the people, in which they find it meaningful to say, this is a Judaism of relationship. Tell me what that means, and tell me how it relates to the way that you practice Judaism, which is different from the way you're down the shul to the left and to the right shoulder?
I have talked about it, and I've written about it, and I'm happy to do it again, although it'll take a little bit of time. But the idea is exactly, I mean, like, the Chavura movement was a perfect outgrowth of the idea of a Judaism of relationship, right? The idea that we invite other traditions and religions into our synagogue, and we talk to them, is a perfect outgrowth of relationship. When you ask me, why do we perform mitzvot? The reason we put on tefillin in the morning is because it's about our relationship to God, not just because God told you to do it. I mean, there are lots of implications. Now, you may like this, you may not like it, but at least it's a coherent ideological framework into which you can put the tradition that we advocate. That's how I would do it.
The family who comes to my shul comes accidentally. I live in a suburban community. There's a lot of other things to do. They come because we have a nursery school, and they have a three-year-old, and it's a damn good nursery school. And that family comes to put that three-year-old into the nursery school. And they come with a particular reticence to join. They don't want to join. They're afraid of joining. They are in every way, Arnie and Steve caught it, they are sovereign selves. They are terrified of joining. They want to be independent. They want to control the transaction. They want to be consumers. And we have to re-socialize them, first out of that consumer mentality, and then in a much deeper way, we have to re-socialize them to think of themselves differently. We have to give them a different self. Not the self which is self-contained and self-absorbed and self-possessed, not a self which is autonomous and independent actor in the world, a self which has permeable boundaries and defines meaning in terms of relationships. Meaning in terms of connection, meaning in terms of openness. That's how I understand the word kedusha. Kedusha is not separation, it's connection. Because every time you use the word kedusha, in kiddush, in kaddish, in kiddushin, it's about connection. And the opposite of kedusha is chol, and chol is sand, and sand is atomized. And that's the lives that they live. And so I have to convince them that the meaning of their lives is found in our capacity as a religious sacred community to bond them to their ancestors, to God, to the community that exists, to the larger community. And the more bonds, the more meaning they get. No. And I have a year to do it. Because if I don't do it in the first year, then they'll stay consumers throughout their career in the synagogue, and when they finish consuming the commodity they came for, namely the bar mitzvah, at the end, they're gone. They're gone. And that's the way, that's what I understand is the task of creating a counterculture of relationship within a conservative synagogue.
Can I ask you both, though? I think we both agree that the whole membership model is failing. Is there something to replace it?
To add to that, one second, Ed, you just talked about the bar mitzvah. The article in the New York Times just a few weeks ago, there are boutique things. People don't even need us for bar mitzvahs anymore. They can rent a hotel, they can rent a rabbi and so on, they can rent the Torah. So David's question, what's the membership model going
to
be like?
Well, I actually would like to say about that, I think it's interesting that I have much smaller shul than either of yours. And not only that, I have a shul down the block from the much larger shul. B'nai Jeshurun's on 88th Street, Anshe Chesed on 100th Street. And so I actually think that the people who are members of my synagogue are not members by default, they're members by choice. Because the easier choice, although we recently did a little investigation and discovered the much more expensive choice is at B'nai Jeshurun.
There's your bumper sticker.
There you go. Cheap and holy.
Cheap and holy.
Judaism for less. And fewer.
Well, we try harder. I think in my experience, my shul bucks that trend a little bit. And I have noticed, by the way, in the publications of Synagogue 3000, an assent to what David just said, that the membership model is failing. The reason that I like to hold on to the membership model, and the way that it works, at least in my congregation, is that I feel that it does give people a sense of ownership. And though you'll read in the Synagogue 3000 material repeatedly that the feeling that dues is a bad model because it induces a feeling of fee for service. My experience is the opposite, that dues induces a feeling of communal ownership. There's no question I think as you look around the world, that we are exactly as Ed says, pervaded by a sense of religious consumers. That is a death knell. That, to me, is the real death knell. Fee for service, we're lost if it's fee for service. And so I think that exactly as you said, our job is to socialize people, re-socialize people. I would watch the rhetoric of effacing the selves that they come with and giving them new selves. But I think that people need to understand that they're part of a community with those goals. I just want to tell you an anecdote that some years ago, the RA had a membership seminar, and there was an evangelical speaker who said, okay, here's what we do. We let anybody come to the church, but you can't join the church. You can't be a member of the church unless you sign on to their mission statement. It's like, oh my goodness. I don't like it for some reasons, but can you imagine that they have, you know, whatever, they have 400 people come, but only 75 of them, or only 100 of them are members? And the point of that is that a high degree of buy-in forms the nucleus around which the community more broadly grows. And I thought that was, you know, I don't think that we who are part of a dwindling can ever say, okay, so don't join. No, we're always going to want you to join. But I think that basic idea of deep degree of buy-in being the nucleus around which the whole community grows, I think, is profound.
But Jeremy, what is the reason?
I'll tell you what we learned from that, and we also learned from David's model. So we did an experiment, amazing experiment. We didn't send them membership contracts. We invited them to the shul in cohorts of 10, 12 couples on a Sunday afternoon and gave them punch and cookies and then took them all up to the bima and sat in a big circle, because I have a bima the size of Arkansas. And we went around the room and we introduced ourselves and talked about where we come from and our journey stories and how we got here. And a couple of the senior guys from the shul come too. And then I talked about the shul as a family of families. And then we opened the Aron Kodesh, because I have an Aron Kodesh the size of Arkansas, and gave every family a sefer Torah to hold. And we said a bracha together. I did this on the spur of the moment. I made it up and said a bracha about what it means to belong, that this is now yours, that these Torahs don't belong to the rabbis or the board of directors, they belong to you. This is our covenant with God and our covenant with our people, and you now belong. You belong to the covenant. And we said Shechianu, and we sang Ose Shalom, and I looked up, and there were tears in everybody's eyes. We said to them, you are covenanted as a member of this community. May we celebrate our simchas together. May we comfort each other in moments of pain. May we raise our children together. May we find God together, find meaning together.
Beautiful.
And then what happened was, I took the Torahs and put them back in the ark. The executive director gave everybody a peckle, a swag bag, full of books and records and their contract. And I thought we were finished. But they didn't leave. For an hour and a half, they stayed there. And they stayed in little circles, schmoozing with the senior guys from the shul. And they wanted to know, how can I get involved? What can I do? Do you know who I am? Let me tell you who I am. Now, it was made up on the spot, trying to figure out how do you take David's notion of covenantal Judaism and operationalize it. And now, we do it for every new family that comes in the door. And now we've created the second step, which is a membership course. I stole this from Rick Warren. I have no problem stealing from the megachurch movement. About how do you create 101? How do you teach people? Because the rhetoric, I mean, quite meaningful, quite deliberately. I'm going to give them a different sense of what it means to be human, a different sense of self, because that's, I think, what we have to undo, is undo this American sense of individualism in order to give them a sense of kedusha.
By the way, we do that exact thing too. Not yet, but we're gonna. And there's Nicole Guzik is already, she's looking at me going, why don't we do this?
So Nicole, the answer was Joshua. He'll tell you how to do it, because he's the one who developed it.
Other creative ideas, ways to reach people. I mean, that's an extraordinary story that you've shared, and I think obviously it's touched all of us.
Well, the notion was this. If you read Rick Warren, and I read these guys because I think they have something to share with us. I don't accept their theology, but I like the way he organizes church.
Yes.
So he has this thing in terms of 101, 201, 301, 401, a deliberate pathway of membership. So we're mimicking that.
The
levels of membership. So just quickly, 101 is introduction. Welcome to the shul. 201 is living a Jewish life. Stuart Vogel invented that, and I took it on from him and created this year-long chavurah learning that teaches families how to have Jewish lives at home. And we give people a lot of stuff. We give them mezuzot to put on their doors and Havdalah candles to do Havdalah. We give them a lot of chazarai so that they understand that this is physical Judaism. And 301 is mentors. We have to create a new class in the shul of mentors. So we took families that we think live pretty exemplary Jewish lives and we taught them to be mentors. It's one thing if I tell them to make Shabbos. But I have a guy who's a cancer surgeon. And he says, look, I'm in surgery, it's Friday afternoon, I can't stop. Well, I get home a little late, but we light candles, we make Shabbos, I bless my kids. It's the most powerfully affecting thing for young families, for families that are 10 years younger, to hear how this family makes Shabbos. And the next level will be to take out of the mentors class 401, which will be leadership. So that the next generation of leadership in the synagogue will be people who have functioned as mentors to younger members in the shul and understand that as part of their deal. We have to use their abilities to teach each other. We can't do it all ourselves. That's the pathway that we create.
So with our topic being in terms of the trends over the 20 years, I think it's important for us to touch upon. David, you introduced the concept of halakha. What do we see vis-a-vis halakha and its role in the lives of our congregants, our shuls itself? Also with the context of ritual, and let me throw in worship, any one of those three. Do we see those things evolving, changing? What models, what needs to change, what needs to stay the same? What's working, what's not working?
I'll just say very quickly, I'm going to say what you already know, which is the model of halakha as command is mostly moribund in our movement. The model of halakha as spiritual fulfillment is the only possible model, I think, that has some sense of being able to survive. That's why I say that you need a framework. Why should I do this halakha if it doesn't fall into a framework like relationship or like growth of soul or something? I don't think it can work. You can't tell people anymore God doesn't want you to eat a cheeseburger. That ship has sailed. And in terms of worship, I see essentially two models. There are smaller, intense, learning, singing communities, right? These are what these alternative minyanim tend to be. And that's very powerful for the people who are there. For larger communities, I think traditional chazanut is waning for most of them, maybe for all of them, which some people applaud and some people are sad about, but it's the reality for most. And I think a more participatory model, a more participatory musical model. Look, we have a couple of serious, you know, Ron Wilson, I don't know if Ron is here, there he is in the back, I thought so. So Ron invited me with Laura Geller to do something with Rick Warren at the Reform Movement's convention a couple years ago, where they get 6,000 people, by the way, just saying. So here was the first thing that Rick Warren said is, when you walk into a synagogue, what's the first thing you're looking for? He said, you're looking for someone like you. So that's why you tend to get people who cluster together and the reason that you don't get, for example, older people in younger synagogues or pregnant women in older synagogues is because people want other people that look like them or they're not going to feel comfortable. And that's why big synagogues tend to get a broad variety of people because they can always find someone that looks like them. The other thing was we tried then to talk about how to create moving worship services. And I want to tell you the two great challenges that we have, and you know. One is, on Shabbos, people can't write. So we don't have their email addresses. And that is, we don't know what their interests are. I get hundreds of non-members every Shabbos. I don't know what they like to do, because they don't write me during the week, and they won't write me during the week, and I can't have them fill out surveys. It kills me, I just want to say. The second thing, and I asked Rick Warren about this, and he actually didn't have any good solutions either, is Hebrew. Hebrew is a high bar. Maybe it shouldn't be, but it is. So even the people in my congregation who can pray in Hebrew have no idea what they're saying, and when they look at the translation, they don't like it anyway. And this takes a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of creativity, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that it's not that it's not a high bar. It is.
Jeremy.
I agree. Mostly.
I thought I saw the Mashiach on the horizon there for a second. Now it's right.
It's going into the casino.
I think that David's analysis is correct, especially about the different sorts of categories of small and large. I think the participatory is absolutely critical. Unsurprisingly, both where I occupy in our landscape, where I personally occupy in the kind of shul where I work and find myself, I think that the high bar of Hebrew is a kind of plus. Let's be aware that the strict church theory of communal thriving is pretty important to folks. You know, the mainstream, or as they say, mainline denominations in Protestantism, as you all know, have tumbled precipitously in the last 25 years, even more than us, their analogs. And the churches that are demanding, in the ways that we spoke about, ideologically demanding and personally demanding, thrive at a much greater level. I think that one of the things that we do for people through the experience of worship that is somewhat mysterious and strange is that we invoke powers essential to religion, which are mysterious and strange. You know, we are interested, you guys are interested, you have mentioned the number of people in your shuls who are not conventionally observant. I am also interested in the flow from our movements of the people who seek to be more conventionally observant, more intensely observant to the right. This I find very troubling. It's in a sense a source of hope for me, because I do not believe that people who accept gender hierarchies in no other realm of their life will continue indefinitely to accept that God wants a gender hierarchy. I think that this is fundamentally ridiculous in the end, and I think that folks will stream back towards our style of Judaism, of traditional Egal Judaism. They may not be conservative institutions, but I think traditional Egal Judaism will thrive. But one of the reasons I think people do stream to the right is because of the aesthetic and spiritual power of participating in Hebrew, and I think that
no, I agree with that too. I agree. It's both a high bar and a plus. We should also say, I can tell you why Orthodox Judaism is doing well. I have the answer, in case you're wondering.
On a bumper sticker?
Yes, on a bumper sticker. Because, guys, as the old Yiddish phrase goes, Jews are like other people, only more so. Worldwide, fundamentalism is undergoing a resurgence. In Islam, in Christianity, if it weren't happening in Judaism, I'd be shocked. So, of course, there's going to be an upsurge in traditionalist Judaism, but I share Jeremy's hope that all they're doing is training next generation's conservative Jews. When it wanes, we will become full flower again. I just hope it may be speedily and in our day.
Amen. All right. Some years ago, the conservative Judaism Journal did a survey, and they asked a large number of RA members, if you weren't the rabbi, would you daven in your shul? And about 80% said no. If you wouldn't daven in your own shul, quit. You have no right to leave here. If you can't see someone in a supermarket and that person says, you know, I'm Jewish, I'm looking for a shul, and you're not willing to say, well, for God's sake, come by us Shabbos morning, it's a great service. Quit. You don't deserve to be the rabbi, that's sin. If your prayer service doesn't move people to embrace what we're teaching, then we're failing and you will die. Prayer is one of those rarefied human things that can only be done with a full heart. You can't fake it. You simply can't fake it. And if you can't stand in front of the congregation and say, this is great, this is absolutely great, this is where I want to be, this is where I want my kids to be, This is where I want to grow spiritually. Well, I'll give you one other out. Fix it. The reason why the Orthodox are doing so well is because people seek passionate authenticity. And Orthodox rabbis believe in what they're teaching. And it's transparent. It's all they are. It's 100%. It's all they are. And sometimes we come off as slightly slick, professional, and phony. We do it well. We put on the bar mitzvah. We invite the sisterhood to the bima. We put on the pageants. We put on the pageants. But after a while, it becomes an empty gesture. Sharon Brousses, my dear friend, said that when they set up Ikar, that was the first thing she had to do. She said, I'm going to daven the way I want to daven. I'm going to pray the way I want to pray. You want to come pray with me? Great. Come pray with me. And they created a prayer service around that nucleus of people. We have to do the same. We have to do the same. I mean, that, to me, it sounds like such a klutz thing. But if you can't say, this is my way of attaching myself to God, this is my generation of meaning for my own selfhood, then it's an empty gesture, and we have the right to survive.
In certain respects, it's the inverse of the famous Groucho Marx line, right?
I wouldn't join any club
that would accept me, right? We'll take the last comments, and then about anything that we'll start with Jeremy. But one question I'll throw out there, and if you want to answer it, fine. If not, that's okay, too. But we've touched upon some of the trends in the secular world and how that impacts upon us. David, you mentioned about fundamentalism. When we talk about the Chavurah movement, that was quite clearly responsive to the countercultural movement of the 60s. If you think about it also in terms of the social justice movement of the early 1900s and the impact that had on Reform Judaism. So the last question I want to throw out, but feel free to pull any and synthesize any thoughts you like. Any trends happening in the world today that you think are going to have an impact or that we should be thinking about, planning for, trying to maximize, and so on and so forth? Jeremy, we'll begin with you and then close up with you.
Well, just to answer that, I mean, I said that I think that that Obama's America is largely becoming much more of a post-ethnic America, and I think that's very, very critical for us to understand. I thought that everything that Ed said was very, very profound. I had a conversation with a friend recently who left the synagogue who said, you know, the truth was that when what I wanted out of Judaism and what they want out of Judaism were just not the same thing, and I feel very blessed to be in the 20%. I definitely would be part of my shul, and I feel blessed that when I say what I want out of Judaism, I think that is what several of you are members of it. I think that's what the people of my shul also want out of Judaism. So I feel very lucky in that respect. I want to say one word about halakha. I think that David's comment that the idea of halakha as heteronomous divine command, God doesn't want you to do these things, is played out. I think that is 100% correct. As a matter of fact, I think it was a relatively, you know, there was the canonical midrash for the last parsha. You know, what's with the para aduma? Yochanan ben Zakkai is asked, what's with the para aduma? And he gives some sort of a fanciful answer. It's like a magic ritual. But then the students say, well, really, tell us what it is. He says, just God's commandment. Nothing you can do, God just says so. I always think, and Rosenzweig says this, that rhetoric was always secondary to a different rhetoric of halakha, which is that it is a vessel for kiddushah and a vessel for devotion. I think that is very, very important. I think that our halakhic observances ought to ask ourselves the question, how does this in fact bring us into experience of the master of the universe? How are they vessels for making life meaningful and sacred? And what I think we should try very seriously to mute is the sense that what we're doing with halakha is avoiding an avera. I'm in favor of avoiding avera. But I think that we have all too often asked ourselves questions when halakha questions come up, say, is this forbidden? All right, you have to ask if something is forbidden. But that is really a way of looking at Jewish tradition and practice as an error to be avoided, as opposed to looking at it as an opportunity for sanctification and an opportunity for making meaning. I don't really want to hear only. I don't want to hear primarily, yes, we can do it because it's not strictly forbidden. I want to hear how we speak about our religious observances as paths for expressing our devotion, as paths for expressing our love, as spiritual and moral searches to l'taken olam b'malchut Shaddai. And I think that ultimately, while the movements to our right do have a rhetoric of God says so, I think that that's not ultimately what they say. What they ultimately say is that when you behave in this way, your life is sacred and rich and more meaningful, and they're right. I think that we have to speak about Jewish observance, about halakha, and we have to make it this way. It'll make you a better person, and it'll make the world a better place. And if we can do that, then I think that we're going to find a lot more people. They may not be home at 4:13 on Shabbat afternoon, on Friday afternoon. You know, that they may not make all the same choices that you will about what products they buy for their kitchen, but I think that they will find, and you will find, that it will all be a much more attractive path of religious living.
David.
First of all, people want different things from different synagogues, and the answer to whether I would daven in my synagogue is sometimes in some services yes, and other times in other services no. And I don't actually feel uncomfortable about that, and I'm not quitting. Because I really do believe that there need to be synagogues that provide different experiences for different, it's why we run many services. Having said that, here's what I understand us to be able to do and why I think that we're right. When we talk about halakha, remember that what we're talking about in halakha is not ritual observance, right? It's relationships between human beings. Bein Adam L'Chaveiro is not about ritual observance for the most part. It's about how you treat each other. When I gave a sermon in my congregation about gossip, that was a halachic sermon. So if we count halakha not as it's okay that I cheated in business because I'm home at 4:13, but we understand that the conservative movement represents the need to relate to other human beings as if they're in God's image, the need to relate to the non-Jewish world as if non-Jews are in God's image as well, the need to relate to other Jews as if we're all part of the same community, the need to relate to God because God is central to our tradition and to our history, and that that embraces ethics and ritual all as one, and it doesn't require a sacrifice of your intellectual honesty, then you'll realize that we really have the goods, that there's a reason why we are conservative rabbis and why we chose this path, and that it's good and that it's right and that it can make the world better. If we are too tzimtzum about halacha and we make it only about specifics, then that's true. It can be empty and arid and sterile. But if we see it as a path of life that is really about, as I said, I mean, look, at the end of the Torah, what does it say about Moses? Does it say he observed the most mitzvot? Does it say he was the best person who ever lived? No, it says he saw God panim el panim. He had the most comprehensive relationship with God. That's what we're here for. That's why we're here, for a relationship with each other and with God. And that, our movement has a patent on, right? We're the only movement that takes Jews and non-Jews as seriously as we do, I believe, and also takes the relationship with God as a continual evolving relationship, not as something that was either fixed in the past or is only defined by the future. We're in the right place. We really are. If we have the right articulation of the message that I think all three of us share for all of the, you know, duking it out over nuance. If we have the right articulation of that message and our lines of communication are unknotted so that they move through the movement, then I think we really will see the kind of renaissance that we all, I hope, in our hearts believe we ought to see.
I have a couple things. The first thing is, it's breathtaking to sit here with guys like this. It's breathtaking that this movement and all of its syrup has created souls, shaped souls, and this passionate and articulate and wise and powerful. So it's a privilege to sit here with you.
I don't know where the technological revolution will go. It seems to me that social networking and all of the tech both divides and unites us, so it's hard to tell. But the futurist Alvin Toffler, many, many years ago, arrived at a conclusion, and he said, the more technological we get, the more high-tech we get, the more we crave touch, real, live, human community. High-tech yields high touch. So my suspicion is that the more that technology finds its way into the daily lives of people, the more that it becomes sophisticated, the more people are going to seek real, live, human community. Touching people, talking to people, speaking with people, and in that way, reaching toward God. And I think that we are to teach people how to do that. What stands in the way of their forming human communities is this pernicious American individualism and the consumerist attitude that it engenders, and their basic inability to know how to bridge that gap and reach out to the neighbor next door, to the friend, to the congregant. And that's something that we need to teach. So this, I want to reiterate this notion of teaching a new kind of self. There is one, however, there's one social trend, and this is my second point, there's one social trend that we all witness right now, and it's going to have profound implications as we go forward. And that is simply that people are living longer. My bubby was a little old European lady when she went to came to take care of me when my brother was born. And then some years ago, I calculated how old my bubby was when she was a little old European lady when my brother was born. And to my chagrin, she was 52 years old. My dad, thank God, is 83 and healthy and strong and comes to shul 4 times a week. My teacher, Harold Schulweis, thank God, is 87 and still preaches on Shabbos. People live longer. Now that's going to mean something to our communities. In my community, there's a very large group of active, intelligent, bright, well-educated, and fairly wealthy retired people who are looking for places to touch, to connect. They can be not only organized and made part of a core of the synagogue, there's something else we need to do with them. We need to enlist them. I've had an interesting encounter with the LDS Church. We all know that 19-year-olds in the LDS Church sign up for mission, and now they get sent to Uganda or places far away. The other thing that's really interesting is that in the LDS Church, when people retire from working full-time, they also sign up for mission. And the LDS Church will take a retired couple and put them to work in the community, serving the community, which gives them a sense of purpose and that they're needed, a sense of that there's something to do of real importance in the world, and gives the community this invaluable resource. This is something we have to do. We have to develop a vocabulary of mission. If not for our young, then for our old, for our elders. And enlist them as teachers of our code, of teachers of our community. That's the second thing I want to say. And the third thing is what I said before. Either we integrate or we disintegrate. I think that what we need is a conservative movement. As long as Solomon Schechter established the American model, I think that we need a constitutional convention. Let's get us all together in a room and figure this out. The chancellor told me that that's suicide. For him, if not for me. The chancellor said it'll never work. And that he would rather work behind closed doors in quiet meetings, and that Julie and Steve and he and others have worked together for the first time in the history of women to begin to bring these things together. That's not, to me, as dramatic and as powerful as a constitutional convention, but I'll accept it. But what it takes most of all is you and me and all of us. This is what my friend Michael Siegel taught me. Because he called me and said, I want you to serve on this committee and help rebuild United Synagogue. And I said, no, you have the wrong number. I've always been a critic of this organization. And he said, and now you'll get to be an architect of the organization. The conservative movement belongs to us. It's going to either be fixed by us or buried by us. We are the rabbis. We are the last line of responsibility here. Either we are going to band together and with one voice, and our leaders, get it
together, fix it. Overcome the bureaucracy and the inertia and the institutional boundaries and all the other, excuse me, bullshit that keeps us from working together as a unified movement, doing what we need to do. Get it done. Jeremy's prediction is going to happen.
You know,
we will be a shrinking. You've done it a minute, and then the rest of the convention is yours. I promise I have nothing else to say. And or else, we're going to be a shrinking, dwindling, heteronymous movement with very little voice to say to the greater American Jewish community. I happen to think that we can do this. I think we have great leaders who can do this. I really do believe in this. I happen to think we can do it. If we decide together as a community, that's what we would do. That's all I have to say. Thank you so much.
You know, Ed, I think you spoke brilliantly. And before people want to leave, I just want to hold up something that you said. Thank you, Shira. I agree with you about the fact that our institutions are in complete need of an overhaul. Not only will you not get not invited back next year, but I published the same thing to that effect this week. And I'm happy to share it with you.
Thank Julie, but also I want to thank our panelists who have done just an unbelievable job of helping to stimulate an important discussion. I think we take about a 5-minute break, and then Ron Wolfson is going to be speaking. So please join me in thanking our panelists.